be called melancholia. Abraham Lincoln suffered from it. Winston Churchill suffered from it and called it black dog. And everybody suffers from it to one degree or another at some time in their life. It's been suggested that there's more suffering due to depression than from any other single impairment affecting mankind. It's by far the most common psychiatric symptom. It's found as a temporary condition in a normal person who has experienced a great disappointment. And it's found as the deep suicidal depression of the psychotic. Signs of depression include sadness, apathy, inertia that makes it difficult to get going or to make decisions, loss of energy, fatigue, often accompanied by insomnia, pessimism, hopelessness, a sense of worthlessness, helplessness, loss of interest, loss of spontaneity, etc. Sometimes symptoms of depression hide an anger that has not been expressed, sometimes is not even recognized, and sometimes is turned inward against oneself. Depression can occur at any age, and there are various types of it. Some depressions are chronic, long-lasting, resistant to treatment. Others are acute, very intense, but of short duration and self-correcting. We would distinguish depression from discouragement. Discouragement is usually mild and temporary, an almost universal mood in response to disappointment or failure or loss. Long story short, depression is common but complicated. It's difficult to define. It's hard to describe and not easy to treat. The word depression is a clinical term and is not discussed as such in the Bible. However, the psalmist cried out in terms implying depression, and there are several biblical descriptions suggesting depression. You might, in your mind, consider the 69th Psalm. I don't ask you to turn there because I'm not going to take any time with it. But the 69th Psalm evidences depression. Kevin read the 88th Psalm, which evidences depression. Again, we see it in the 102nd Psalm. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Hide not thy face from thee in the day that I am in trouble. In the day when I call, answer me speedily. Incline thine ear unto me. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth. My heart is smitten and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. By reason of the voice of my growing, my bones cleave to my skin. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I watch and am as a sparrow alone upon the housetop. Mine enemies reproach me all the day, and they that are mad against me are sworn against me. For I have eaten my ashes like bread. I have mingled my drink with weeping because of thine indignation and thy wrath. For thou hast lifted me up and cast me down. If that's not depression, I don't know what to call it. And yet, these songs of despair are set in a context of hope. In the 43rd Psalm, David proclaims both depression and rejoicing. Why are you in despair, O my soul? Why are you disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I again shall praise him, the help of my countenance and my God. It seems that Job got depressed. Moses got depressed. Jonah got depressed. Peter got depressed. Jeremiah wrote a whole book of lamentations. Elijah saw God's mighty power on Mount Carmel, but when Jezebel threatened murder, Elijah fled into the wilderness and plunged into despondency. He wanted to die, and he might have, if God hadn't given him some rest and some food and some assurance and a friend. God knew what he needed. Then there was Jesus in Gethsemane, where he was greatly distressed. He began to show grief and distress of mind and was deeply depressed. And he said to his disciples, "My soul is very sad and deeply grieved so that I am almost dying of sorrow. Matthew 26, verses 37 and 38. These examples of despair show the realism of the Bible. But this realistic despair is contrasted with a certain hope. Each of the believers who plunged into depression eventually came through to a new and lasting joy. The biblical emphasis is less on human despair and more on belief in God and the assurance of abundant life. Paul's confident prayer for the Romans was, "Now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Spirit." Romans 15, 13. The prevalence of depression in our country is staggering. It's the common cold of psychopathology, and it's touched the lives of us all, either directly or indirectly. And yet, it may be the most dimly understood, it may be the most inadequately investigated of the major mental distresses. Nevertheless, we do know something about the causes of depression. Depression often has a physical basis. Lack of sleep, poor diet are among the simplest causes. The effects of drugs, low blood sugar, other chemical issues like brain tumors and glandular disorders are more complicated. Just as one example, the hypothalamus is just a little piece of your brain about the size of an almond, and it controls all kinds of things. If it doesn't work right, you can get depressed. Severe depression tends to run in families. I don't mean that it's inherited like blue eyes, but yet some people are probably more innately prone to depression than others. It seems that childhood experiences can lead to depression in later life. Depression seems more likely when parents blatantly or subtly reject their children, or when they set unrealistically high standards which the children are unable to meet. Failure becomes inevitable, and so people become depressed. Sometimes depression comes in situations over which we have no control. Loss of job, loss of health, loss of freedom. Sometimes even the loss of a contest or a game. Loss of possessions. Loss of loved ones is one of the biggest depression-producing events in life. When we learn that our actions are futile no matter what we do, and no matter how hard we try, then depression is a common response. We feel helpless and sort of give up. This can be seen in a grieving person who can do nothing to bring back a loved one. It can be seen in a student who is unable to relate to his peers and unable to succeed academically. It can be seen in an older person who is powerless to turn back the clock and restore lost physical capacities. We find that when such people regain at least a little control over their life, control over a portion of their environment, that depression tends to subside. Some people slip into a pattern of negative thinking in which they see only the dark side of life and overlook the positive, so that life is seen as just a succession of burdens and obstacles and defeats in a world that is going down the drain. They often view themselves as deficient and inadequate and unworthy and incapable. And this can lead to self-blame and self-pity. They view the future negatively, seeing it just filled with hardship and frustration and hopelessness. Somebody asks, is negative thinking a cause of depression or the result of depression? And it's probably both. It's a vicious cycle. Negative thinking is sometimes used to control other people. Saying I'm no good is sometimes an unconscious way to get people to say, oh, you're good, you're good. It becomes a way of manipulating people to give you a compliment, but those kind of compliments really aren't very satisfying. Negative thinking can be used as self-protection, because if I keep thinking negatively, then I'm less likely to be disappointed if some of my negative thinking comes true. Anger is an issue that seems closely related to depression. Many children are raised in homes where the expression of anger is not tolerated. Some people are convinced that they should never feel angry, and so when they do feel angry, they deny it. A widow may feel anger that her husband has left her to raise the children, even though it obviously in most cases was not his fault. But since this anger seems irrational, it just arouses guilt in her. and the anger is denied and kept within. It festers undercover and eventually gets her down. Most anger begins when we feel hurt. And instead of admitting this hurt, people get angry. The anger builds and hides the hurt. And if the anger is not admitted and dealt with, it leads to revenge, thoughts of hurting somebody else. But violence is not acceptable, so people try to hide their feelings. And this takes a lot of energy, and it eventually wears us down and leads to psychosomatic symptoms. Some people condemn themselves for their attitudes and become depressed. There's an emotional self-punishment. Then they begin to feel no good and guilty and unhappy. Some people use their depression as a subtle and socially acceptable way to express anger and get revenge in a passive way. Resentment is the accumulation of unexpressed anger. Resentment is the most destructive emotion in human relationships and probably in personal well-being as well. It's easy for people to begin to wallow in depression as a means of hurting other people. The depression itself becomes an indirect expression of hostility. I'm depressed and there's nothing you can do about it, but it's all your fault. And if you don't give me some attention, if you don't give me some sympathy, I may get even more depressed and do something desperate. It's a kind of a psychological blackmail. Suicide attempts frequently have this characteristic. There's a kind of a see what you made me do quality to them, or a now you'll miss me quality to the suicide notes that I have seen in many cases. Other communications that surround suicide have this quality to them, or suicide attempts. They blame others for their bad feelings. Depression often hides an underlying hurt or anger or resentment, which is then forgotten. We forget the cause, but this has to account for some depression. Guilt feelings and depression often appear together. In many cases, the guilt comes first, but depression will cause people to feel guilty because they can't just snap out of it like they feel like they should be able to. So there's, again, a vicious cycle here. Problems that we experience can serve a useful purpose for us. When we are physically sick, we get excused from work. People shower us with attention or sympathy. People take over our responsibilities. Sometimes we can enjoy a little R&R when we're sick. And the same is true when we're emotionally down. So there is a motivation for this sometimes. But even though depression does help us to avoid responsibilities and does attract attention to us and does give us an excuse not to function, emotionally hurting people realize that the benefits of depression are not really very satisfying. So they begin to hate what they're doing, and they often end up hating themselves. And this creates more depression. And they lack enthusiasm, they're indecisive, they don't have much energy for doing even simple things like getting out of bed sometimes. In some people, depression is hidden even from themselves. So it comes out in other ways, including physical symptoms and aggressive actions, temper outbursts, impulsive behavior like gambling or drinking or violence or destructiveness or impulsive sex, accident proneness, compulsive works. These symptoms are often masking a depression that occurs in children and adolescents as well as in adults. Smiling on the outside, but hurting on the inside, and expressing this hurt in ways that hide the real inner despair. There's often a desire to get away from other people, since social contacts may be too demanding, and trying to escape into a world of television or novels or alcohol or drug use. Some people dream of running away from their life, and a few people even actually do this. Suicide and suicide attempts by depressed people are especially prevalent among teenagers and among people who live alone and unmarried people, especially the divorced. For some, suicide attempts are an unconscious cry for help and an opportunity for revenge or a manipulative gesture to try to attempt to influence other people. Somebody in particular is often aimed at as the hopeful influenced one. Some people very carefully plan their self-destructive acts, while other people just drive recklessly or drink excessively or use a lot of illicit drugs or find other ways to flirt with death. Depressed people are often passive and nonverbal, poorly motivated, pessimistic, and have a general what's the use attitude. So, how can we help somebody who's depressed? We need to reach out to them in a verbal way, taking a more active role with them than we might with a different type of person. We need to make optimistic statements to them, reassuring statements to them, encouraging them to talk, asking questions which are probing without prying. Give periodic compliments might help. Periodic compliments that are true, not flattering. We should listen attentively to them when we can get them to talk. Watch for evidences of anger. Watch for evidences of hurt and negative thinking. Watch for a poor view of self on their part. Watch for feelings of guilt. Encourage the person to talk about the situations that are bothersome to them. Try to be understanding and accepting of their feelings. Watch for talk about losses and failures and rejections. When you're talking with a depressed person, are you impatient? Are you inclined to let your mind wander while they're talking? Depressed people provide a test for our Christian love. We need to be aware of their special needs. They have a special need at that time in their life to be dependent on us. So I need to ask myself, am I encouraging dependence in an already dependent person, or am I helping? Am I encouraging anger? Am I encouraging negative thinking? It's possible to inadvertently increase the depression rather than help it. What about medical approaches to depression? I believe that if a person is chronically depressed, the first thing they should do is get a good physical examination by somebody who's qualified to give it. Some of the new generation of antidepressant drugs can be very, very helpful. And if you need it, you need it. If you need it, you ought to use it. There's no shame in this whatsoever. The medical community also continues to experiment with pulsing electricity through the brain, which has helped in some cases of depression. Depression is obviously easier to deal with if we can find the physical or psychological or spiritual causes which are producing it. So questioning and careful listening helps us to gain clues about this. Is there a learned helplessness here? Has the person learned how to feel helpless just by habit? Maybe we can help them learn how to accomplish things that they can feel good about. Discuss the inevitability of uncontrollable events. And discuss that in the largest sense, God is always in control. Is there negative thinking on the part of this person? Ask the person to state some of those thoughts and then ask them if a particular conclusion is really valid. Maybe the person says to you, well, my dad likes to see me miserable, so he's insisting that I finish high school. So you might ask, well, is there any other reason why a father might want to see his son finish high school? Do we have to conclude that he likes to see you miserable and that's the only possible reason that he might be wanting you to finish? In other words, are you telling yourself things about the world and about yourself and about the future that really are not true? Are you lying to yourself? This is very common, to lie to ourselves. Challenge the person's thinking and teach him or her a habit of evaluating negative ideas and help them to learn to think more positively. And here, Philippians chapter 4, verse 8 is our hallmark. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8 needs to be our theme. Whatsoever things are true, honest, just, you know the list as well as I do. Whatsoever things are pure, lovely, of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. You think that can't make a difference? I know it can. I know it can. Is there stress concerning a loss? Then you can discuss practical ways that life can go on. Is there revenge covering anger and anger covering hurt? These emotions must be discussed and expressed, even if they seem irrational. We're talking about emotions. They're often not rational. Hurt can be deeply embedded and sometimes can only be uncovered by lots of probing and careful listening. Hurt can so easily lead to depression that even the person himself or herself doesn't understand. Are there feelings of guilt? What caused those? Has the person confessed the problems to God and to others as appropriate? Does this person even know about divine forgiveness? And what about forgiving oneself? You might want to, in a tentative way, give some of your own insights and observations about a person's situation and just get their reaction to that. Most people don't just snap out of depression like they might like to. The road to recovery is long and hard and marked by lots of fluctuations in mood. So encourage people to ponder their automatic thoughts. When a problem or disappointment comes, ask, what do you think about that? What is your automatic thought? Many people think, well, what just happened proves that I'm no good. What just happened proves that I never do anything right. These self-criticisms usually are not based on solid fact. So people need to reevaluate depression-producing thoughts and attitudes. I knew one woman who eventually learned, late in life, that her depression came from an attitude which said, I should be a perfect hostess and mother and wife and friend. I should never fail. I should contribute to the community by serving on committees and making contributions to everybody who asked. She set such high expectations that it was just impossible to reach them. And then when she failed, she became depressed. We need to hold ourselves to God's standards with a balance that acknowledges human frailty. We need to each make a list of priorities for our lives and then figure out how much we can do without becoming angry, frustrated, exhausted, or sorry for ourselves when we fail. We need to help each other evaluate our attitudes and expectations and values and assumptions. Check your assumptions, because a faulty assumption can throw the whole building on it. You build your life on the foundational assumption. If the assumption is off, then the whole building is going to be off, like a faulty cornerstone. We need to help ourselves see when our ideas are unrealistic and non-biblical and harmful. We're talking about thoughts that are well entrenched here, resulting from a lifetime of thinking. So it may take repeated efforts to help people reevaluate and change their attitudes. When people are depressed, they want to feel better. But feelings by themselves are hard, if not impossible, to change. Telling a person, you shouldn't feel depressed, only makes it worse. Just adds guilt feelings to what they're already feeling. Most of us cannot change our feelings at will. To change feelings, we have to change thinking. Thinking is what we can change. And actions. Actions we can change. So we need to focus on the thinking that's producing the depression and the actions. Inaction is very common in depressed people. It's easier to stay in bed or sit alone brooding about your misery than it is to do anything. And that doesn't help the depression. That's the problem. Depressed people need to be gently encouraged to act, to do something worthwhile. Encourage them to do things in which they are likely to succeed, and then compliment them when they do succeed. This increases optimism. It interrupts the tendency to ruminate on negativity. When they do take action, then encourage them to take more. Try to protect depressed people from harming themselves. Sometimes they'll want to change jobs when they really shouldn't, and they're not even equipped to make that decision at that point. Sometimes they want to quit school when they'd really be better off to continue. Often they make unwise marriage decisions. Help them to understand that two miserable people don't make a happy couple. Help them to see the possible consequences of the decision they're making and urge them, in many cases, urge them to at least wait a while before acting on this decision. A lot of depressed people contemplate suicide, and many of them give prior clues about their intentions. I don't think we should hesitate to ask a person if they have been thinking of suicide. Not everybody agrees with me on this, but I believe that this gets the issue out in the open. It lets the person consider it more rationally than perhaps they have been. Rather than encouraging suicide, as it's sometimes assumed, open discussion often reduces the likelihood of suicide. If somebody threatens suicide, take that threat seriously. Try to be available at least by phone if you possibly can. And then do whatever is appropriate. Take the person to the hospital, contact their doctor, contact their relatives, whatever needs to be done. Be careful how we talk to them, but we do need to talk with them and try to help them get a more realistic view of their situation. One time a man called me. It was early on a Sunday morning. I was about to take off and leave town. He was just on the verge of killing himself. He considered this before, and he had finally decided this was the day that he was going to kill himself. He said, she'll be better off without me. I'm just going to kill myself. And I said, well, She may be better off without you, but I know as soon as you're dead, she's going to call me and want to arrange a funeral. And I don't have time for a funeral this week. Could you wait till Thursday? Could you wait till Thursday? And that'll throw your funeral in next week when I'll have time to do it. He promised me, yes, he'd wait till Thursday. I said, do you promise me that you will not kill yourself before you've talked with me again? He promised me that. So I had those two promises from him. I went ahead and left town. You know, he never did kill himself. He was encouraged to wait a while. And by the way, some of you knew that man. I wouldn't be telling the story if he had not already passed from this life. Possible that somebody here could maybe guess who it was. And I don't want to identify the man, obviously. He's gone now, of natural causes. He never did kill himself. He was encouraged to wait a while, and things just looked different on Thursday than they had on Sunday. Somebody said suicide's a permanent solution to a temporary problem, and that's often a true statement. Now, if a person really is determined to kill themselves, there's little that anybody can do to prevent it, and we all need to remember that when somebody does commit suicide. Otherwise, we may wallow in unrealistic feelings of guilt ourselves, that we didn't do something to stop it. It may not be possible or even desirable to prevent all discouragement, but long-lasting depressions in many cases, if not most cases, are preventable. We need to really learn to trust in God. Paul learned, and the emphasis there is on the word learned. He learned in whatsoever state he was, therewith to be content. It didn't come naturally, but he learned that. He learned how to live joyfully, both in poverty and prosperity. He had a conviction that God is alive and in control and can give hope. And that beautiful chapter that Dale taught us so well a couple of hours ago, the last part of 2 Corinthians 4 and all of 2 Corinthians 5, it just is such a perspective changer to when somebody really believes that and applies that thought to their lives. If we cultivate that conviction, then discouragements don't need to hit us as hard as otherwise they might. The second verse of What a Friend We Have in Jesus says that we should never be discouraged. I do not agree with that. I think that's false. I don't think there's any scriptural support for it. I think we should be discouraged when things aren't going well for us. There's nothing spiritually, ethically, or morally wrong with cloudy days and dark nights. They are inevitable. Jesus warned us that we would have problems. James said that trials will come to test our faith and to teach us patience. And he said, count it all joy. But he didn't mean by that to pretend that we never get discouraged. Our Lord, just before the crucifixion, was deeply depressed and openly acknowledged this. We can hardly imagine Jesus in Gethsemane smiling and laughing, or on the cross trying to convince everybody that he was just bubbling over with happiness. That doesn't make sense. He trusted his Father, but he expected pain, and he was not surprised when it came. So we're realistic enough to expect pain, and we need to be informed enough to know that God is always in ultimate control. And then we can handle discouragement and keep it from slipping into a deep depression. Some people slide into depression when they dwell on past injustices or failures. We need to ask God to help us forget the past. And we must forgive those who have sinned against us. And we must forgive ourselves. The church needs to continue to teach people to admit their anger and admit their guilt, and then show how these can be dealt with and overcome. When people learn to handle anger and guilt, a lot of depression can be prevented. Each one of us probably talks to ourselves silently all the day long. We're telling us ourselves something. We need to pay very close attention to what we tell ourselves. Example, 1 Samuel 27, verse 1. David said to himself, I will now perish one day by the hand of Saul. Now, David knew that wasn't true. He knew it was wrong, but he lied to himself anyway because it felt comforting. It allowed him to get by it with and have an excuse for being depressed and then do some things that were wacko. He told himself a lie and believed it, and he did it on purpose. And the result was predictable. 16 months of compromise in the life of David. The sweet singer of Israel, who wrote at least 73 of the Psalms, was mute during this year and 4 months. Then finally, Long story short, alone in the ruins of Ziklag, David looked up for the first time in 16 months and learned that the purpose of depression was not to throw him on his back, but to drive him to his knees. If I tell myself that I am incompetent, I need to ask, what's the evidence for this? In what areas am I incompetent? Is it bad to be incompetent in some things? How can I become more competent? When we challenge our thinking and the thinking of others, this can prevent or reduce the severity of depression. The Bible talks about meditation on the Word of God. In His law doth He meditate day and night. The Bible directs our minds away from the negatives when we meditate on God's Word. It's possible, although I said we should help to protect depressed people, at least at first, it's possible to overprotect. This interferes with their ability to learn how to cope or to master the stresses of life. If people see how others cope and then learn from that how to cope themselves, circumstances seem less overwhelming and depression is less likely. It's been shown that religious people are less suicide prone than non-religious people. Religion integrates people into groups like the group that we have assembled here today. Groups where they are less lonely and less isolated. The church, as God formed it and planned it, is a therapeutic community given to us by God. It's a concerned group of people who have learned to care. That doesn't come naturally, but they have learned to care. And they can do so much to soften the trauma of crisis and to provide strength and help for each other. Lynn and I know that when our son, Clint, was killed 3 years ago, the church was just absolutely wonderful. Just absolutely wonderful. And we thank you for that. Depressed people help themselves when they reach out to other people. Those who help are the ones who benefit and are helped the most. When we help people, including depressed people, it does wonders to keep ourselves from being depressed. And the motive is very important here. It won't help me much if I don't care about other people, but I help them just because it's a way for me to feel better. But when there is a caring reaching out, everybody is helped and depression is reduced. There's nothing in the world like the stimulation of the helping community called the church. God delivered Peter from prison, but he left John the Baptist in a dungeon to be murdered. Now, what was the difference? God only knows why he worked it out one way for Peter and the other way for John the Baptist. Probably had something to do with John the Baptist having served his purpose, and Peter had more work to do yet. But these are things that you and I do not see. God only knows. The point is that Peter released from prison and John the Baptist put to death in prison, both of them were ultimately okay. And we're right back to 2 Corinthians 4 and 5 again. Both of them were ultimately okay. That's realistic. We need a realistic perspective on life and on death. I'll leave this lesson with you. If the gospel invitation is appropriate in your case, if you need to respond to it in primary obedience or otherwise, let us know how we can help you by coming to the front as we stand and sing the number that Jack's about to lead.